Welcome to Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. This is a special episode, and I am on location at ISTE 2017 in San Antonio. So during this episode, I've talked to some friends of ours, friends of the show, about some new things happening in our world. But before we get to the interviews, I want to thank our sponsor for the night. It's the great folks at Jamf Pro. Jamf Pro is the solution for managing, deploying, and securing Apple devices. Over 3 million students are empowered by Jamf every day. You can bring learning to a whole new level for your students and your teachers by providing the tools they need to be successful in today's classroom environment. Start a free trial at jamf.com. That's J-A-M-F.com. For our first interview, we are talking to some friends of ours at Jamf Software about what it's like for them heading into WWDC and kind of how they see the role of MDM going forward in the educational ecosystem stack. Hey, I'm on location at ISTE 2017, and I'm here with Michael Devins and Sam Weiss from Jamf. I wanted to sit down with them because, you guys know that Fraser and I are big fans of Jamf as customers, but they're, we're customers of Jamf and of Apple, and we rely on them to make things work. They have a whole different experience with Apple because they have to make whatever Apple makes for their products, they have to make it work for their customers. And guys, introduce yourselves and tell what you do at Jamf.
Awesome. Thanks, Bradley. This is Michael Devins. I'm a product manager at Jamf, and I focus on exactly as you describe, our support for Apple and the integration. So as they come up with new capabilities, helping to lead those priorities on our teams and bring that new capability to our customers.
And I'm Sam. My official title is Evangelist, which is an awesome title, but really what it means is I'm the conduit between the Apple sales teams and the Jamf sales teams, making sure that we're all working together because every one of our customers is one of their customers.
Yeah, we, of course, we purchased Jamf through Apple, and the unique thing was, is our school was one of the first that had to have a new SKU made for us because we did a 4-year lease, and you guys don't do 4-year programs, and so I did a 3-year and a 1-year to get me my 4-year. I wanted to pay for it all up front. So guys, I can sense the terror sometimes probably you guys feel about May, because you're finally catching up from all the stuff from last year and fixing the bugs and all that, and we're heading into WWDC again. What is y'all's mindset leading up to all the announcements? Because I imagine you guys find out a lot of the stuff from the sessions you go to as well. So what's that like leading up to it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, what's been interesting over the last couple of years is Apple's actually increased their frequency of releases as it relates to delivering value to the market through both a spring release and a fall release, where traditionally we just had WWDC in the fall release. And so that's great in that we get to deliver more of these things to our customers on a higher frequency, but it definitely means that we really get, you know, all hands on deck and really focus towards that WWDC kickoff, because we learn, as you said, just like everybody else, with what's new and then rapidly get to work to build support for it.
Sam, you know, when you're talking to prospective schools and you're talking with your existing clients, do you sense that like a lot of schools are paying attention in the summer of what's coming, or do you think most people are waiting until you tell them about the new features?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think Apple has such a compelling education offering right now between Classroom, managed Apple IDs, like all the great stuff that's going on. It's going to take the whole market about 2 years to really understand why is Apple and iOS the best platform for the classroom. So we talk about this stuff, and I just did a webinar last week on shared iPad, and it's awesome. We get excited about it, and we almost feel like we're kind of the microphone that people listen to, because Apple's going to come out with it, but when it comes to how and actually implementation, people really do look to us to help guide them down that path.
And the great thing about the focus that we've seen on education is being able to put this functionality out in the spring means that our education customers can actually begin adopting it.
Yes.
That subsequent fall, the timing is much more appropriate for these education focused.
I mean, iOS 9.3 put us on a totally different schedule that I feel schools are much more comfortable with.
Yeah, I agree. And that was, from a hardware perspective, when the iPad moved to off of a spring release, it did become difficult because, you know, when they release things in the fall and you were kind of signing your leases the next spring, you're like, you're buying stuff that's almost a year old. But on the flip side, iPads have gotten so mature. Even if you're buying like not the newest, it's not like it's going to, you know, we're not running A5s anymore. I mean, and again, most schools, I would dare say, are not even deploying the iPad Pro.
that was just announced, either the 12.9 or the new 10.5, and there are some schools that may be doing that. But from a cost perspective, the iPad that's got an A8, that's a compelling device for a lot of schools, and the education pricing is $299, and that's an incredible deal. And in my opinion, that puts the Chromebook discussion. It's no longer about price. It's about what can these things do comparatively. Because, I mean, yes, you can get Chromebooks for $150, but they're garbage. And I'm not saying Chromebooks are bad because they have their model and what they can do. But if I'm going to deploy Chromebooks school-wide, it's going to be a $250, $300 Chromebook that's going to last. And again, I feel like Apple's kind of changed that argument a little bit.
The thing that's so exciting about this new iPad, as compared to the Pro or the Mini is... It seems that Apple's really focusing, especially looking at the education market, on like what needs to be there and what's not critical for success. Smart connectors and pencil support, those are exciting capabilities, but deploying iPads at scale while still having the performance there and support for things like shared iPad, it's really exciting to see this new iPad meet those needs, check those boxes, while still kind of hitting that aggressive price point, which education customers need.
And I think you're so right. You know, the iPad 2, we still see those out in the wild. That's the iPad that will last forever. I consider this new iPad to be the iPad 2 of 2017. At $299, it's going to stick around forever, and thankfully it's super capable. Between shared iPad, the Bluetooth functionality, like it's all there to be a fantastic iPad for years to come.
Now, what does it start at 32 gigs or is it 64 gigs?
32 gigs.
So, yeah, so that's certainly, you probably couldn't run 5-6 students, you know, on it, but yeah, you could certainly get a couple of shared iPad students. And again, you know, you could say, okay, the Smart Pencil is incredible. And maybe you deploy some iPad Pros for your art students. You know, it'd be more specialized. Because, again, the A8, it's A8X, I believe, and it's very capable. And it's funny, you mentioned the iPad 2 being around. I literally was by y'all's booth earlier, and somebody may have asked you, Sam, hey, we have iPad 2. Can it work with Jamf? And I don't know if it was you or not. And this person says, like, long as it can get to iOS 9.3.5 or something like that, like, it'll work. And so it is crazy. Those things are still hanging around. Mm-hmm. To me, one of the big announcements for education this year was the ability to sideload devices into device enrollment program. And yes. Typically, just as some backstory for our listeners, device enrollment program is where you can do supervision over the air through your MDM. And that is one of the huge reasons why I've never been a big fan of BYOD, because you lose out on some of the capabilities by not supervising over the air, and a lot of the new features for management are coming only to supervise over the air. So this change, you can sideload devices into DEP, and then the user, the device has 30 days to withdraw themselves, or obviously you can decommission it later from the server. And so, you know, you'd say, okay, why, you know, is this a BYOD thing? Possibly. This also could be like if people just hand you iPads, or hey, I found one on sale, I want to donate it to the school.
That's a great problem to have.
It
right?
is, certainly
people
is.
Give you
but
iPads,
the problem yeah. is like before this, if someone gave me like 10 iPads, they're harder. Like I can't do and manage them the same way as I do the ones we buy and they're in DEP. So is this something that you think schools are we're running into, and this is a response from Apple?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I don't know what Apple's thinking. I wish I did. That would be great insight to have. But I do know that there are these huge concerns around how to have uniform deployment strategies, how to take full advantage of supervision over the air with the device enrollment program. This is sort of a new baseline requirement for doing a lot of these education deployments. And, you know, there are things that people have asked for in the past, like I just want to be able to submit serial numbers or go through some process. And to get to Apple's credit, what's so beautiful is the elegance of the solution, like using Configurator, setting these devices up as you might have done before to supervise them, and then giving this provisional period where there's still that end user opt-out step there. And then they're just treated as device enrollment program devices, like the elegance of that and meeting this need that so many schools have. Because as you point out, donations, buying off of leases, all the different ways you procure hardware to get iPads in the hands of students, there's now a route into the device enrollment program that's not only elegant, but really solves a lot of those concerns we've heard over the years.
Yeah, one of the vendors here at ISTE is a Mac buy and resell place. And they had to be loving that announcement, because then they can go to schools and be like, hey, we can sell y'all iPad Air 2s that are off lease. Those are still great devices, and they can still take all the full functionality. And I like, Michael, I like the term you use, uniform deployment strategy. I think that's the term I'm going to steal, because that was great, because now it doesn't matter if it's BYOD or if it's institutional owned, you can deploy them the same way. Of course, you have to remember, you know, if you're listening, If you do a BYOD, before, when you bring them into the device and rent program, it'll wipe the device, will it not?
Yeah, it's a part of setting up and supervising a device with Configurator 2.5. There's a beta out, and it'll release in the fall. And that'll have support for iOS 11 and tvOS 11 devices to get added to DEP. So the important thing to remember is that there's still a place for BYOD devices. This is not a mandate to say put everything in the device enrollment program. But for those devices that, from a management perspective, were treated as BYOD with over-the-air enrollments, the special path, if those are, in fact, institutionally owned, now IT can treat them as institutionally owned, do management capabilities that are relegated only for device enrollment program devices. You can sort of flip that bit in the way that uniforms IT's experience when they're institutionally owned, and still have support for BYOD when students bring their own devices, teachers bring their own devices, but really reduces a lot of friction in that process.
And building on that term, when talking to schools about what types of iPads do you have, are they DEP eligible, we'd almost be making recommendations. Do something different with your non-DEP iPads. Give those to teachers. Mm-hmm. Make sure that your students have the DEP. So it is fantastic that we're leveling the playing field. The third-party reseller market becomes a huge play for schools. It's taking schools that bought incorrectly. I'm doing air quotes for those who can't see. Bought incorrectly. It's going to help them wipe the slate clean, start fresh, and take advantage of iPads as if they were purchased directly from an eligible partner.
Now, you guys offer multiple kind of iterations of Jamf now. You have Jamf Now and Jamf Pro. What are the differences between those?
Yeah, to distill it, Jamf Now is mobile device management with no IT expertise required. A really low friction way to get into management for the key value things like I need to deploy apps, I need to deploy standard configurations of Wi-Fi and security. It's completely hosted, it's per month, no contract, like lowest friction you can imagine to get into device management, and paired with like some of the new classroom capabilities where you don't need complex MDM support, Jamf Now really makes a lot of sense for smaller deployments and pilot schools. Meanwhile, on the other side of the spectrum, we have Jamf Pro, formerly the Casper Suite, which has been around for years and years, a leader in the Apple device management space, sort of that complete IT lifecycle management of devices to deploy, manage, configure, and get all of that content deployed throughout your organization for teachers, for Apple TVs, for students, and integrating with a whole array of different services to make that ultimate end user experience, that Apple technology experience possible for your users. What else would you add to that, Sam?
You know, I think Jamf Pro has the features that it's not just about getting the devices out for schools. It's lifecycle management. It's wiping the devices, repurposing for next year. Jamf Now is a great utility for people that have the needs that it solves. And the great thing is it's three devices for free. People can sign up and very quickly make that determination. Do I need this or do I need something more complex? And then it also helps them. For people that are new to MDM, DEP, VPP, and APNS, it's like, wow, that was acronym soup that I didn't need. Jamf Now really distills that to what's important, do you have the checkboxes, go ahead, manage your devices.
Yeah, I've now got a reoccurring calendar appointment to, it's like in April, to renew all my push notification certificates, all that, because if you let that expire, that is very difficult to recover from. So, there is a lot of acronyms to throw around. What percent of your customers would you say are, like, we're a hosted school, so we don't have any on-prem servers for you guys. Are you guys seeing a trend more towards that from your new customers? Are you seeing existing customers migrate to the hosted platforms?
Yeah, we have a lot of customers migrating to the cloud, and there are a lot of customers that have requirements that make on-premise actually the right solution for them, so that's not going away. But what's important to understand is that managing infrastructure is not necessarily a core value proposition of that end user experience in the classroom. And so with Jamf Cloud, we see so many customers turning to this hosted subscription or this hosted solution as a way to focus on creating the end user experiences, configuring and deploying the devices without having to manage firewalls and worry about server infrastructure. And again, there are times and places where that's actually critical to the deployment, not just in education and commercial as well, but the reality is that there's such an appeal to call it outsourcing that infrastructure, that the subscription offerings with Jamf Cloud are really a compelling solution that a lot of customers are going for. We're seeing a huge uptick in that adoption.
In education, I'll say at least this year, overwhelmingly cloud. Here's my reason why I like cloud. When Apple puts out new features, people want to take advantage of it right away. They don't want to have to open a ticket with IT to upgrade the Jamf instance, bring it back online. This takes the speed that Apple's moving at nowadays, and it lets people's infrastructure stay up to date with it. So Also, most schools don't want to manage a database, as it turns out.
Yeah, I mean, that's, and so like for our school, for example, my rule is I need things cloud just because I'm one person. And obviously, like today, I'm out of the office. I'm out of town. And I, there's a lot of things. If I want to bring in our email on-prem, I want to bring in our Jamf on-prem, I want to bring in our Wi-Fi stuff on-prem. We use Arrowhive's cloud-managed Hive Manager NG, and we use the G Suite. And all of our core apps are cloud-based. If we want to bring all those in-house, I then have to hire someone to help me manage that stuff. And it's from a budgeting perspective, it's easier for us to say, okay, we pay this for the cloud hosted, but it keeps us from hiring somebody. Hiring people are way more expensive than, when I hire you guys, I don't have to pay your payroll taxes and things like that. Michael, you mentioned Apple TV, and that has gotten a lot more interesting in the management space. Tell us about really what's new there.
Yeah, so in the spring with tvOS 10.2, Apple gave a real boost in the capabilities with Apple TV and managing these fourth generation devices, which are the devices that can run tvOS 10.2. Headline capabilities include support for the device enrollment program. If you've ever enrolled an Apple TV prior to this spring, you've used USB cables and configurator, and you've set aside the better part of a day. And all of that was the only path into management. And there were very few things you could manage. You could manage Wi-Fi and a few basic things. AirPlay being the value driver to putting Apple TV in the classroom. And with tvOS 10.2, Apple introduced device enrollment program support, and it's like almost like magic. So you plug in power, you plug in Ethernet, and you connect it to your display, and you watch. And after about 30 seconds, it detects the network, and it just auto-provisions touch-free setup to your home screen. Like, you don't even use the Siri remote. You can deploy enterprise apps. You can deploy conference display mode. What a novel way to set up conference display mode. Just deploy a configuration profile. But if you're deploying custom apps, you can do single app mode, a number of new restrictions, and more capabilities to come in the fall with tvOS 11. Some of the things you see on iOS will be available this fall, like home screen layout, show hide apps, etc. So it's a really exciting boost to functionality. Again, people were deploying Apple TVs, I'll go out on a ledge and say, purely for that AirPlay experience, right? And so to be able to extend that now to a rich app ecosystem with the third-party apps we'll see coming in the future, being able to remotely configure all of these things that are important, including in the fall setting the AirPlay password, not just defining it on the player on the iPad. So a lot of exciting capabilities, really making Apple TV more of a first-class citizen in the management world with more robust capabilities for more of the use cases we're seeing being adopted.
Sam, I know what we're using Apple TV for at our school, but what are your schools doing with Apple TV?
You know, up to this point, it's been a lot of AirPlay. There's been some really cool new things, like the way Keynote supports AirPlay with using the markers and the highlighters, but it's honestly been a lot of AirPlay. So now what we're seeing, now that Apple's changed how we can deploy tvOS, it takes the maturity of the iOS platform, DEP, app configurations. I want to talk to you again in 6 months and tell you how schools are using iPad or Apple TVs in the classroom, because it's going to change incredibly over the next year.
Yeah, I'm really excited about the ability to deploy them quicker. When we use Apple TVs for our digital signage, and when I'm going to configure one, it's like, what I actually do is take them home and configure them at home. I'm like, my kids are running around our playroom, and I'll configure it at home, then take it to work. Because it's like a tedious process to set it up, connect it to the Apple, right Apple ID, and it's just like, because I can't use the remote on my phone because it's tied to my Apple ID, and it's been a lot of hand-holding, and it feels a lot like deploying iPads about 3 or 4 years ago, where it's like you're setting it up basically as you would a home, your home device, but it's going in the enterprise. So it feels, and I think this is, we're seeing the benefit of the similarities between tvOS and iOS, where they can move really fastly on these new deployment mechanisms.
And you just hit a key component of why it's hard today. Apple makes devices for consumers. They make enterprise deployment methods for enterprises. So no worries that your TV, setup took a long time, but because people bought so many and because they were used in places they weren't forecasted to be in a lot of schools and a lot of enterprises, I think Apple was almost forced to treat it as a manageable operating system. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and again, if you look at it from, I was thinking the other day, like, what Apple platform is the best for accessories? And if you look at the Apple TV as an accessory, because probably if you're buying an Apple TV, you already own an iPhone or an iPad or a Mac, one of those products. Like, it's the most profitable accessory on the market. It's a $159 device, and my hope is that if we see new Apple TVs in the future, this current one, which is a really great option for schools. Yes, it's missing 4K, but for the school's needs, nobody cares. No, I don't need 4K in my school for many years. If that Apple TV comes down to $99, maybe even $79, that's a really compelling device as well that you could, again, see into a lot of classrooms. It's going to be very easy to display for conference display mode. You know, one of the things, we've been using Apple TVs for conference display mode back to the 720p Apple TVs, which, just pro tip to anybody listening to those, if you still have one, you need to sell that because it's worth a lot of money on eBay. So if you still have an Apple TV that looks like iOS 6, find it on. You could probably buy a new Apple TV with the money you sell the old one for, because they were very hackable. We were using Flickr screensavers for display mode. It just, I mean, we're, to me, it was always great because this was before like Fire TVs were a thing, and people would use computers and literally plug up VGA ports from computers to monitors. And now it's like you know we Velcro the Apple TVs to the back of it, and it works really well. So, guys, is there anything else that you kind of want to think about as you guys head to look forward to iOS 11? What's on y'all's mind right now on getting your customers up to speed?
I am beyond excited about how open Apple has been recently with connecting to other systems. So just as an example, Apple School Manager, direct integration with three of the most popular SISs today. We're seeing the Files app support cloud-based storage services. We're seeing more and more cool things with Apple integrating the Playground, Swift Playgrounds, recently integrated with Sphero and Lego. So I'm excited for an Apple that's looking to embrace what's already out there, what's already popular, and build that into their applications for a better experience. It's been an awesome year, and I can't wait to see what happens next.
Yeah, Files may be very key going forward for Apple iPad schools, because we still don't have a way. I got some premises. Apple doesn't have its own identity stack, and Fraser and I talked about this, where you can't say, okay, I want to deploy iPads and I'm not using anybody else's software technology. Apple doesn't offer email for schools, so you're going to be deploying a G Suite, an Exchange, one of those. And the cool thing is now is, yes, there's no solution for iCloud, extra iCloud storage for student-managed Apple IDs, but if you're a G Suite customer, they're going to, you're going to have native access to the Files app. It's not going to be another app that you're going to have to deal with. In fact, because some of the Google payloads, it's almost easier to deploy G Suite on an iPad than it is managed Apple IDs. And that is different, a different Apple, that they're making it so easy to work with competing platforms.
I know Fraser is really strong on that managed Apple ID storage limit. I follow both you guys on Twitter, so...
Well, it is hard, and it's hard because when you run into that, like, you just don't have an option.
Yep.
And, like, it's not even like we can't afford it. It's like there is no technical option, I'm sorry. And the Files app, I think, is going to be really important because, again, it's making it where the iPad isn't like the third-party platforms aren't second-tier citizens. It's just like it is on the Mac, where Dropbox and OneDrive and Google Drive work the same as iCloud Drive in a lot of instances. And one of the examples that Fraser and I talked about in the last episode is, you know, like on iCloud Drive right now, when you drop a file in there, it's just there, and it uploads in the background. Like, you don't have to wait on it to, quote-unquote, upload. Well, in Google Drive right now, you have to, like, export it out, import it into another app. I mean, it's a whole song and dance. Well, with the Files app, Google Drive will be able just to work like iCloud Drive does and just upload in the background. And you don't necessarily have to know that you're not in iCloud Drive. It's going to be a really nice system.
It's funny you say that, because I almost did a webinar that got axed for marketing because it felt a little too aggressive. But the best Chromebook is an iPad.
Yeah, I mean, you could make an argument. I wish the Docs app would come a long way, but the. The kicker is the identity stack for a lot of schools is G Suite, and the iPad is getting a lot more compatible with G Suite going forward. I'm still not used to that name, G Suite. I'm still not used to that name at all. Michael, any parting comments as we look forward to this summer?
Yeah, no, I'm just really excited with the direction that I see Apple heading. As I mentioned earlier, there's this platform unification story unfolding. You know, we've been managing Macs for a long time, and now we're starting to see the mobile device management framework and configuration profiles kind of backfill a lot of this functionality. iOS being a really mature platform and funneling down to tvOS, and even some things coming to macOS. caching servers being built right into every version of Mac OS High Sierra. Like, there's so much consistency and connectedness coming to this story, paired with the third-party integrations we talked about earlier. It makes our story at Jamf easier because we're talking about a more unified management platform, and that's something we can support in a better way, I think. But also, it changes the narrative for the IT admin's workflow, and having a more cohesive management story for the devices and deployments, that it's the Apple platform. It's not Mac OS, iOS, TV OS, maybe someday Watch OS, and that sort of connectedness, moving from the consumer, disparate devices at your home to enterprise deploying Apple, I think we're really starting to see a strong narrative there, and I'm excited to see where it goes.
I think we'll know we've hit peak Apple unification when I can trigger our testing profile from my watch for our iPads. That'll be when we've reached the peak. So, guys, thanks for coming on. We'll have links to ways you can contact Sam and Michael in the show notes. Guys, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Next up is a vendor that I talked to at the Jamf booth. Actually, they have an interesting digital signage app for the Apple TV. Fraser and I have covered that in the past episodes, and they have a new take on it with the new technology that you've seen in more full-featured PC-based applications with zones where you can divide up the screen into different parts. So let's talk to them.
I'm here on location at ISTE again, and I've got Scott Douglas here with Tightrope Media Systems. And I came across Tightrope at the Jamf booth, and they have a pretty interesting product that works very nicely with the Apple TV that they were demoing at the Jamf booth. So, Scott, say hello and tell us about what Tightrope does.
Bradley, thanks for having me on today. Tightrope Media Systems is a digital signage company, and we've been doing digital signage for 20 years, but we introduced a couple weeks ago the ability to use an Apple TV as the player with our system. So we're the first commercially available digital signage software for an Apple TV player.
So talk about how, I mean, obviously you've got the app on the Apple TV. Is it just one of those things where everything's configured on the back end, and once you launch the app, it just takes over?
Correct. We're a server player model, so there is a centralized server that hosts the software to run it all, and then it pushes it out to the Apple TVs for the player devices. You log in using a web browser to the server, create your content, manage the content, and then it pushes it out to the channels running on the Apple TVs.
Can you do, let's say I had 10 displays. Can you have 5 doing one thing and 5 doing another?
Correct. You can have 10 doing all different things if you wanted to do that. So in our language, a channel is what you see on the screen. It's broken up into zones. You can do multiple zones there on that channel. So you could share a zone amongst all 10 channels if you wanted to, or it could be on just one channel.
Yeah, so for those who kind of can't picture what zones are, you've seen like restaurant displays, where they may have a ticker at the bottom with like the local news, and they may have the menu at the top. And that's basically, those are two separate zones. From a deployment standpoint, you mentioned server software. What's that deployment like?
So it's a virtualized server installation onto your hosted server hardware. We download it, install it. It runs off of SQL database. It's pretty straightforward, very easy to do.
What kind of content can you put in these zones?
You can do static images when we give you templates to create the statics. You can do video, and it can be Windows-based or Apple-based videos, whatever you would like. We also do dynamic content, so you can bring in your calendar from an iCal feed or your RSS feed or Twitter and Facebook and other social medias, weather, those types of things.
So let's say you had a designer on staff that was making custom images, you can load those just as easy as you can make something on site.
Correct.
So there's really no short of content you can't put on there.
That is correct.
What excites you guys most about developing for tvOS and Apple TV?
So this is a new concept, but it allows us to go into, we've been doing educational clients for a long time, but this allows us to put it into the classroom. This allows us to, with that Apple TV, we can now put the messages in every classroom, not just out in the hallways. We can also override that. If they're in the AirPlay mode, we can override that with an emergency notification so that the customer sees exactly what's going on, and we have control over everything that way.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking before with the folks from Jamf about you know, before these set-top boxes came along, you kind of had to have a computer connected to TVs. And that was very expensive. And then depending on where the TV was, could be a very long VGA cable.
Correct.
And now you can literally use, you know, buy a $150 Apple TV, Velcro it back to the back of the TV, plug it into HDMI, it can run off of Wi-Fi, and you're up and running very quickly.
Correct. And with XAMPP's management software, it's all configured for you. You don't have to put in any, you know, any Apple IDs, anything along those lines. And it's set up and it runs for you. And you can put it in single app mode and it runs.
So what is your purchase model like? Is this a per display thing, or is it a one-time fee, or is it you just do like a site license?
So we're a perpetual license. There's a server fee based upon the number of players or Apple TVs that are attached to that server, and then there's a player fee per player, but it's one-time cost. It is not a monthly or a yearly, or, you know, that's one-time up front.
Okay, so yeah, so you're not, it's not, if you could have, you know, you're not be paying hundreds of dollars per month when, you know, you just figure out what you have, then you can pay for it, and I assume you can upgrade later as well.
Correct. We offer server licenses in 5, 10, 15, 30, 60, or enterprise level number of players that will attach to it. If you start off with a 15, you've got 10 players attached, you want to add 7 more, we've got to upgrade you to the next level. But it's just a license
fee.
Where
do you think, 2 or 3 years from now, where do you guys hope that the Apple TV goes in terms of capabilities for you all? Do you guys have any things on your wish list?
So obviously, we want it, because it's brand new, there's lots of things that are in development and working to make it easier to use. But, you know, a teacher can log into her website, into the system right now, and create whatever she wants to show up on the screen, and it's playing in her channel. But the schools can also have their announcements come in as well. So there's lots that can come.
Well, I could even see something where you imagine if you could, say, divide the screen up into, you know, even just a bottom thing was for school news, and then maybe be able to set an AirPlay destination for that iPad where you would always have the school news at the bottom, but you could still have that AirPlay functionality. There's a lot of options there.
There's a lot of options that way, and it's new, so we're still working on some of those things.
Well, Scott, thanks for coming on and talking to us. We'll have a link to Tightrope Media Systems' website in the show notes, but it's at trms.com, but we'll have a link to that in the show notes at outofschool.net. Scott, thanks for coming on.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Finally, our last guest is Aaron Gates from Aerohive Networks. He works in technical marketing and just a super great guy. I met him last year at ISTE, and he's one of my great friends at Aerohive. And he's very, very smart, but also he knows how to break down really complex things into understandable technology for the masses. So let's get to Aaron.
So I'm here again on location at ISTE 2017, and I am here with Aaron Gates from Aerohive Networks. And I've known Aaron for, I guess, about a year personally, and I've been reading some of his articles on the internet for, feels like, many years. And so it's great to put a face to the name last year. So Aaron, tell our audience what you do at Aerohive.
So I work in the tech marketing department, and I also dabble in technical training as well. So my day-to-day is many things under the sun. I maintain the tech marketing labs. I do demos at trade shows here. So when you walk by our booth, you see the NG demo or our self-registration demo. That's all me on the back end, supported by Andrew, of course. And then I travel around the United States doing technical training. So when customers want training on our management system, they send me out. We do a two-day training where we just basically run you through how to use NG, how to make your whole network, what do you need to do.
Hive Manager NG, if you're not an Aerohive customer, is there a cloud-managed platform? And I think that's something I always try to make sure everybody understands. It's one of the things I love about Aerohive and have since 2011 is when it's cloud-managed, not cloud-controlled. Mm-hmm. And so there's nothing in the managed system that interacts how your network works. So I always tell people the story I had somebody told me years ago, that they had one customer that was so concerned with security, they ran their Hive Manager on a local thumb drive. They would boot up in a VMware instance, make changes, shut it down, and lock it in his desk. And the cool thing is the platform is that flexible. Obviously, like you can't gather stats and view the dashboard of what people have been doing, but your local network still operates. And so, to me, That was always the secret sauce and what makes Hive Manager unique. And we've been on NG, Next Generation, as kind of the naming. We've been on that for about a year. It's been a really, really nice upgrade. But the cool thing is, if someone is still on Hive Manager Classic or Hive Manager, I've been a customer since Hive Manager 4. I could have pushed out a configuration on Hive Manager 4 and never touched it again, and those access points would still be working today.
Yep.
There's nothing in the manager system that interacts with controls how the system works. So that to me is one of the biggest reasons I'm a big fan of Arrowhive. So Aaron, what do you think is the greatest challenge for Wi-Fi in schools today inside the classroom?
Well, actually, funny you asked that. We're doing Wi-Fi Feud at our booth, so we actually queried our customer database to see, what do you guys want when you're looking at Wi-Fi in education. And the number one thing we got back was, I want it to just work. And I want it to be easy to set up. Which, I mean, being someone who does networking in my house or does networking for the company, that's the number one thing. You want it to be easy to understand, easy to set up, and it works when you do what you think you're doing. So, if I'm sending out an SSID that is .1x, I want to make sure that it actually communicates with the radius server that I thought I set it to. Or if there's a button in the config that says turning off lower data rates helps with sticky clients, I want to actually have that happen. So I want it to be easy to set up, and I want it to work the way I expect. I want it to just work.
Yeah, I kind of equate it to like how I am with my car. So a lot of people love to tinker with cars. They like, they want to know how they work, and I don't really care. And I just want my car, when I turn it on, that it starts.
Yep.
And so I think what you're saying is a lot of your customers, they're that way with their Wi-Fi. They don't really want to tinker with it. They just want it to work. They want to deploy it quickly, and they just want it to work. And my thing has always been, our teachers and students, if they know which Wi-Fi vendor we have, it's not good. They shouldn't care.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, they shouldn't know. Like, they shouldn't have this preconceived notion of, like, oh, this vendor I have is like, oh, we have and they're garbage. No one should know that we have Arrowhive. They should know that we have really fast Wi-Fi, really
exactly.
Stable Wi-Fi. But they shouldn't know, outside the IT staff, they shouldn't know who Arrowhive is.
Yep.
I like to tinker a little bit with my Wi-Fi. But, a good example for me is this, is with home automation stuff. I like it a little bit, but I want it to work most of the time. And
yep.
So, like, I'm that way with Wi-Fi. It's like, I'll tinker a little bit, but, like, I don't log into Hive Manager NG every week. I'm in there a couple times a month checking stats. I get the weekly update. Like, I'll check the stats every week. They'll send to me what was used last week. But I don't want to go in there and have to be changing out configuration stuff weekly. I just want to get it and set it and work. And
set it and forget it.
I'm that way about my washing machine. I don't want to tinker with it. I just want it to work. And I think, that's the thing. It's like, you just, like, you put your clothes in there, put soap in there. I just want it to work. That's
good perspective. And, yeah, which one's more valuable?
Right.
There.
You just want it to work. So what's the, and you're dealing in education, what's the most common mistake that you see that most schools do with their Wi-Fi networks?
Well, there's two. There's the vendor neutral answer I'll give you, which is, I see a lot of channel or 2.4 gigahertz usage. So you'll get a lot of overlap, and especially bonding on 2.4, please don't. And generally, just channel reuse is not very well understood, I think, in the education sector. Because when you're in IT education, you're not the Wi-Fi guy. You're generally the IT guy, and
right.
Wi-Fi happens to be something you got thrust upon you when the last Wi-Fi guy left. So it's one of those things that you see people doing without really knowledge of it. This is the way it works at my house, so I think that's the way it should work at my school, and it doesn't really translate one-to-one. So I'd say the biggest thing, vendor neutral, that I see is people oversaturating their 2.4 or using 5 gig in a non-great channel reuse setting, so 80 megawatt channels, 40 megawatt channels. Now, putting on the vendor cap, I think the biggest issue I see is schools using just PSK networks.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had a couple students in my classes, or I've had a couple of people come up to me at trade shows, and we talk about what's going on in the network, how can we recreate that in NG, or how can we improve it. And the number one thing I see is they have a PSK SSID, so a standard everyone puts in the same passphrase you get on the network, and everyone's happy, but they're all treated the same. They all have the same firewall policies. If someone leaves or is disgruntled and you have to change the password, if a student gets a hold of the password, I just had a class last week that I was teaching NG, and a student came up and was telling me that kids at their school were actually selling the passphrase to get on the network. $2 a pop. So if someone comes up, oh yeah, I'll give you the passphrase, here you go. And the issue with that is exactly what I was just talking about. You know, everyone's treated the same. Everyone has the same firewall rules. Everyone has the same access policies. Whereas one of the things that I really love about Aerohive is private pre-shared key. Every single person can have their own unique credentials that we can track and we can treat differently.
And so you can revoke.
And revoke, yeah. You can. So it works. It acts like .1x, but without the complication of rolling out a Radius server, doing certificates, public key infrastructure, everything like that. And so I'd say from a vendor standpoint, that's the biggest mistake I see on education networks is having a straight PSK network instead of a PPSK network.
So one of the funny stories that my normal co-host, Rager Spears, he's in Scotland. He's another Aerohive customer that he says he has. He is funny. A PPSK story is he limited his students to two devices with their PPSK.
Okay.
Well, when Apple introduced the sharing of Wi-Fi passwords across iCloud,
yeah,
students had multiple. It was shared like it's like kids' iPad wouldn't get online. Maybe they gave them one or something. Basically, like, their phone connected first because it got their credentials from the iPad's iCloud. And then iPad wouldn't go online because the phone was already online. And so it was like, oh, so, like, you know, just kind of an unintended effect because it was obviously easily fixable. But it was just kind of funny. But one of the things you guys kind of have been pushing over the last year and we're taking advantage of is access points that have a software-definable radio. And so it's turning a 2.4 gigahertz radio into a 5 gigahertz radio, so having an AP that does dual 5 gigahertz. I know your 250 does it, and
the 550.
And the 550. Yeah. So how does this help schools?
Yeah, so that sort of gets back to the mistake or the shortcomings I was talking about on education networks where you reuse 2.4 too often, and you only have 3 non-overlapping channels. So you're either going to use all 11 of them and overlap, or you're going to use 3 non-overlapping, but then once you get that 4th access point in there, you're overlapping again. So the idea becomes, how do I take full advantage of my network? Because once I get to 4, the options left to me are turn that 2.4 gig radio into a sensor or turn it off completely. And, you know, if you turn it off completely or turn it into a sensor, you're pretty much paying for an access point that you can only use half of. And I have customers that complain about that. You know, I'm paying $600, $700 for a commercial-grade access point. Why can I only use half of it? And what's really great about rolling out a software programmable radio is you can switch from 2.4 to 5. So instead of taking that 4th access point and just turning off the radio, you switch over to 5, you get increased capacity. You get students can now connect. You can connect more students to that access point. So instead of, let's say you're doing 20 students per radio, instead of having 4 would have been 80 plus 80, 160. I can do math. Instead of having 140 students, now you can get 160 students on your network. It's just overall increased capacity, which increases the user experience.
Right.
You don't have people calling you in IT saying, hey, the Wi-Fi sucks, I can't connect to it. And you don't know why, because it's all set up, it's all working, I can get a good signal. Instead, it's people getting on the network, you getting fewer calls, everyone being happy. So, overall.
Yeah, and so we go back to the 2.4 channel reuse. So if you've got, you know, radios, you know, in a perfect world, in a perfect 2.4 world, a user could only see 3 radios at once. And the radios could only see two other ones at once. That's how 2.4 works.
Yeah.
But the problem there is that really limits you from a capacity perspective. So I'll tell you one of the ways we're using the 250 and the dual 5 gigahertz is on Sundays in our Family Life Center, the gym becomes a worship service for our church. And it's really hard in gyms to get Wi-Fi, get cabling places. In gyms, it's a two-story gym with a walking track up top, so it's very high. So you've got free space path loss you would lose on the way down if you get them all the way up there. So I have Wi-Fi around it well, but it's just difficult. It was always a challenge. So I realized, let's put a couple of these 250s in here, just set them up for Sundays, and then we unplug them during the week. And it was like great capacity. I mean, that's where I have the highest. I mean, I may have 800 users, you know, on the network on Sundays. And like these 250s having the dual 5 gigahertz gave me a lot of extra capacity. So yeah, to me it was just a great product, and the nice thing is you're not just buying a dual 5 gigahertz; it can be either.
Exactly.
And so that's the great thing is it's a software definable radio, so you can go back and forth with a simple config change.
Well, and I mean even better than that, we noted that you have the ability to switch from 2.4 to 5, and we noted that not everyone's network is going to be 100% 5 or 100% 2.4. It's mm-hmm. a fluctuating ratio. So we actually built into the product the ability to switch the radio automatically. So the access points now will be sensing the users on your network, and let's say we rotate from a 50-50 distribution of 2.4 and 5 to now newer clients are coming in, you now go to a 20-80 distribution, you can actually have your access points automatically switch to a dual 5 gig mode mm-hmm. to handle that extra capacity.
Yeah, so it just does it automatically now?
Yeah.
Oh, that's I didn't know that. That's awesome. That is awesome. You know, we all thought 2.4 gigahertz was dead, and I was calling it dead for many years.
It'll never die.
And, yep. and you know, the one of the issues is the Internet of Things devices rely heavily on 2.4 gigahertz, A, because it's a lot cheaper to integrate,
yep.
battery life is easier, so it doesn't look like it's going away anytime soon. And although it wasn't supported in 11AC, it is supported in 11AX, which is still a couple years away. It's probably 2019 before that thing... 2019, 2020.
Before it gets officially ratified. Yeah,
and yeah. so it's nothing that's, I mean, it's on the horizon if you're in the Wi-Fi industry, but like your average school, nothing you're going to hear about for a couple years.
Yeah.
But it does come back. And so thinking about 11AX, thinking about 2.4 gigahertz, what do you think schools should be thinking about, you know, in 2020? What does 11AX do for a school? So we went from 11B, 11A, 11B, 11G, 11N, 11AC, 11AC Wave 2, and now 11AX. What does 11AX do?
Haven't you had enough Wi-Fi already?
Bingo.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you look at the history of wireless, it's always, well, it started off with how do we get it faster? And then it really took off when A came out and G came out, and it went from a nice to have to a necessity. So, the IEEE gets back together. Okay, people are taking care of this, or people are using this, and we need to get it even better. So how do we make it even faster? And they come out with 11N, which rocks the PHY world in Wi-Fi. And everyone takes on to that. It's great. And that actually came out in sort of the same fashion as AC, where you had draft N, and then you had ratified N. And then AC, the idea was, again, we did well with N, but we need to really, really... beef it up to compete with wired, because people still say, oh, well, wireless is good, but it's not as fast as wired. So the IEEE goes back to the drawing board, says, okay, well, let's take everything we've done and make it even better. And they roll out a standard that theoretically can get you to 7 gigabit per second. You won't, anyone who is thinking of designing a network, please don't design a network up to that standard, because you're using 160 megawatt channels, which that's a whole other topic we'll get into. Or we could get into, but it rolled out a great speed boost. And then what we figured out was speed isn't necessarily the problem. What the problem is congestion. So the idea is you can widen the lanes, or you can help deal with carpooling. So why not put a bunch of people on a bus, and that's 24, 50 cars off the road? And that's where AX comes in. They said, well, we upgraded all the speed. We updated everything we could physically. Let's make it so that we do better reuse. And you go back to what I said with 2.4 or 2.4 gigahertz in schools and reuse patterns. It's not just schools. It's everywhere that the channel reuse is not well understood by the Wi-Fi guy. I'm using air quotes for listeners, the Wi-Fi guy, because it's always someone who just had it thrust upon them. I mean, there are a few experts in the world. I think the CWNP program is up to 230, 240 right now, sure. So AX, what it does is it basically says, okay, we're going to take the same space that we have now, but we're going to put subcarriers closer together, and we're going to use OFDMA, which is not a mutation, but sort of an evolution of the OFDM technology, so that way we can send to multiple clients at the same time. It's the next evolution in multi-user MIMO. So you get that, and then you also get coloring of SSIDs. So a big issue with 2.4 and 5 is overlapping BSS, which I wrote that article on, but also it's co-channel interference. If someone is on the same channel as I am, since wireless is half duplex, I can talk or I can listen. Well, if we're on the same channel, I need to stop talking while the other access point is talking. So I'm instantly lowering my throughput. AX comes out, and they're taking from, another 802.11 standard, AH, I think it was, that was built for IoT devices. And they said, hey, that's a great idea, is we can color the SSIDs. So if your neighbor is using wireless on the same channel you're on, which is bound to happen in 2.4 because it's never dying, we can actually look at the first bit of their SSID and say, this is not the same service set as the one that I am subscribed to, so I can treat that as noise. I can actually talk over that. So it's a great way to basically increase capacity even further. We rolled out, how can we get things faster? Now we need to roll out, how can we use it in a more efficient way?
And do more at the same time.
Exactly.
You know, one of the things that, you know, it's we, on a lot of our 5 gigahertz, we have 20 megahertz wide channels at our school. Mm-hmm. And no, that doesn't look as sexy on a speed test as 80 megahertz.
Definitely.
But no one can tell. I mean, like, you know, a lot of the speed tests, you get to a certain point and no one can tell. And what makes a Wi-Fi network... faster speed is not going to make a network feel better. More capacity makes a network feel better.
Exactly.
And especially with mobile devices, I mean, you've got these single stream radios in the phones, and you've got lower power devices and everything iOS for battery savings. And then so it's not just about like, okay, I need 300 by 300 on a Wi-Fi test. It's like you do yourself better to do 80 by 80, but have the ability to have more people to get 80 by 80
exactly.
than fewer to, you know, and that's the big challenge in K-12, especially in higher density environments, is like having 10 people be able to get one speed test is not as good as having, you know, 300 people get 50% of that speed test.
Exactly. Because, well, especially if you go for those, as you call it, as you go for the sexy numbers, you get rid of your channels that you can reuse. The whole point of going to 5 gig and AC was... I have 24 channels that are 20 meg wide instead of 3 that don't overlap. Mm-hmm. Well, then you introduce channel bonding. Okay, great. I go from 24 down to 12 when I go to 40 meg wide channels. Mm-hmm. I go from 12 down to 6 when I go to 80 meg wide channels. I mean, you're almost at that same level at 2.4.
Yeah, 80 megahertz gets you basically double the channels that 2.4 gets you.
Yeah, and then you'll hit interference again because you're stepping on your own toes when you have to reuse more than 6 access points that can see each other. So your speed test goes back down. So why not stay on the 20 megahertz and get better capacity for
right.
your network?
And again, and the cool thing is you can mix and match. So if you've got a part of your building, it's like there's literally, you know, they've got one access point out there. There's nobody else can see it. No, the clients can see it. Yeah, crank that up 1 to 80.
Yep.
But if you've got especially in schools, if you've got first floor, second floor, you may think, oh, there's no access points down here, but they may be above you
exactly.
or maybe below you. And so you're way better off to have slightly slower speeds, but give yourself more capacity from an overall end-user experience. Because very few, I mean, in the reality is, if you get on a Wi-Fi network that, like, it's not your home, and, like, we have at our school, we have 400 by 400 fiber. Well, I can get that. If I'm wired into wired Ethernet, I can get 400 by 400 on the speed test for my ISP.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter, though. And if I do a... on the areas we have that are 20 megahertz on my phone, if I do a speed test, I'm probably going to get 80 by 80. But you know what? The speed of 400 by 400 to 80 by 80 when you're on the public internet feels the same. I mean, there's you're limited. I mean, if I can get 400 by 400 on my, or 300 by 300 on my phone, what I'm connected to on the other end has to be able to support
exactly
that. What? And in most websites and most services aren't set up to take 400 meg
definitely
connections.
Not. No. I mean, it goes back to cars on a freeway again. I mean, if I buy a Ferrari and I have the ability to go that fast, I'm still going to be stuck in traffic behind
right.
everyone else. So I'd rather get a car that's more fuel efficient,
mm-hmm.
or I'd rather get a car that's more reliable. So just, you know, stick on.
That's a great analogy. Just because your car can go that fast doesn't mean A, you should, or B, that you'll ever be able to.
Yeah.
And in reality, you're better off to. It's kind of like when you. They're doing some construction near our house, and they're taking a 2-lane road to a 4-lane road.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah, I mean, it's like we've got to go through all the construction, but it's like now we can more cars can go along that road at the same time.
Yep.
And that's ultimately eliminates traffic.
Yes.
And that's the same concept. We're trying to eliminate traffic. I always tell people Wi-Fi is like a door. In wired networking, if you have 10 devices and they're wired in, every device gets its own door. On wireless, every device has to go in that one door. It's a shared medium. And so you have to, anything you can do, you know, and if you make the door bigger, That's great because more people get in and out at the same time. If you make the door smaller, yes, maybe the door opens faster because it weighs less or whatever, but then fewer people can get in and out. And so, like, what's better? Yeah. It's all about traffic. So this has been really, really exciting. You've written some great articles on Air Alhive's Boundless site, which I will link to a couple of them in the show notes as well, talking about, there's one, a great one on channel width that I kind of keep around and keep bookmarked. And when talking to schools about slow Wi-Fi, this is the one I send them because it helps understand that just because you can do 80 megahertz doesn't mean you should.
Exactly.
Just because your car can go 120 doesn't mean you should. And so we'll link to a couple of those. I'll link to your Twitter account in there as well. And so, Aaron, thanks for coming on. We appreciate you hanging out with us and talking Wi-Fi with us.
That's my pleasure.
Well, that wraps up this week's episode. We'll be back next time with Fraser, back to our normal pair of co-hosts. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Hope you enjoyed this special episode on location at ISTE 2017.